Good morning. Welcome again. Yesterday I introduced the topic of field semantics, and I gave you an idea of what I think is the basis for collecting linguistic data, especially data on linguistic semantics, from native speakers of languages the researcher doesn't speak in the field. Okay, this works. Today I want to elaborate a little bit more on that. The two lectures today will be about field semantics, and we're going to start this morning with methods for collecting data for semantic research in the field, and then in the afternoon I'll talk about how to analyze that data, and that will also be the topic of tomorrow morning's lecture. Okay, so basically, what I'm going to do in this lecture right now is I'm going to offer a classification of elicitation methods, methods for eliciting data in the field. And to begin with, I'm going to try to clarify this notion of elicitation itself. And once we have an overview of the possible approaches to elicitation, I'm going to try to illustrate the various types with examples from my own field research. All right, so remember that I said yesterday that when you're doing field semantics, and in fact any semantic research on an empirical basis, meaning on the basis of observation rather than on the basis of interpretation, then that entails that you have to start from the observation of extensional data, referential data, the kind of entities and states of affairs that the native speakers are referring to when they're using the utterances of their native language. So, given that, it shouldn't come as a surprise that I'm going to argue that any approach to data gathering in semantics, and in fact in linguistics in general, can be classified in terms of three principal components. A stimulus, that's that referential correlate that the speaker is referring to, that the speaker is talking about, a task, and a response. On the slide, you see a sort of cartoon illustration of that idea, a very pedestrian example. This is me asking a Maya speaker, "How do you say I've got to go?" Okay, so the task is a translation task, and I'm giving this task to the speaker in their native language using Yucatec, Bishkuyala. But then for the utterance that I want to translate it, which is my stimulus, I'm using the contact language, that's Spanish. Tengo que irme. And the response is a target language utterance, meaning an utterance in Yucatec, Pare que me voy, which means I've got to go. Okay, so that means we have these three components. My claim is that any kind of linguistic data gathering from speakers can be classified in terms of these three components, but you don't necessarily have to have all of these components in place. In fact, in the simplest case of linguistic data gathering, all you have is a response, no task, no stimulus. That is the recording of spontaneous speech events, which is the kind of data that you have to rely on in conversation analysis in particular. Why? Because you're interested in the strategies that the speakers of the language use in order to negotiate the structure of their conversation, which is something very interesting from a sociolinguistic perspective because it reveals a lot about the underlying social structure. But if you want that kind of data, it's important that you as a researcher don't interfere with the conversation, because you are going to have a certain place in society, and that is going to warp, it's going to influence the data that the speakers, the utterances that the speakers will produce. So what you have to do is extract yourself from the equation. That's why you only get a response, no task, no stimulus. There's no control whatsoever of the researcher. Doing this in the field, in an indigenous community, is actually the hardest thing that you ever get to do in field research, in my experience, and I've heard that confirmed by many colleagues. Why? Because you cannot just put up a camera or a tape recorder somewhere, let's say, in a store or on a street corner, and ask people to just accept that you're recording them while they're going about that business. People will find that incredibly intrusive, and they will question your motives. People in industrialized nations may be more likely to accept that kind of thing because, well, we're used to researchers watching us do all sorts of stuff. But from the perspective of people in indigenous communities, that's a very strange thing to do. So this is difficult. Conceptually, it's the most simple thing that you can do, but the realization is very, very difficult. And there are ways to do it. We can talk about that if you have questions. Okay, so the next possibility is you have still no stimulus, but you do have a response to a task. And this is, in fact, the staple, the main approach to data gathering in the tradition of fieldwork that was created, or at least is most commonly associated with the name of Franz Boas, the founder of linguistic anthropology, and in many ways also the founder of the linguistic study of indigenous languages of the Americas. So the classic thing to do in the Boasian tradition is to shove a microphone in the speaker's face and ask them, okay, tell me a story. Tell me a story about the old times. Tell me a story about how people used to live. Tell me how this particular ceremony of yours used to be carried out. Okay? And so Nicolaus Himmelmann, in a seminal article on language documentation, called this staged speech events because they are being produced in response to a request by the researcher. Otherwise, there isn't much control of the researcher. You're basically getting maybe a traditional story, maybe a historical narrative according to the linguistic practices of the community. But the fact that this happens at this particular moment in time is caused by the task given by the researcher. And once you have all three components in place, a stimulus, a task defined with respect to that stimulus, and a response to both, that's when we can speak of elicitation. Sorry. All right, so to make the distinction between stimulus and task a little more concrete so that people can't accuse me of being vacuous about this, here are some simple definitions. Semantic elicitation task is a speech act directed at the participants by the researcher intended to trigger a set of computations involving the semantic system. And the semantic elicitation stimulus is a verbal or nonverbal representation intended as the input of the task. Now, in comprehension and judgment tasks, the input, meaning the stimulus, is an utterance. And in production tasks, the stimulus is something you give to the speaker that constrains the content of the utterance to be produced. We might want to say it defines the content, but that's slightly naive because it's the speaker who defines the content. It's the speaker who construes the stimulus in some way or another. So at best, the stimulus imposes a constraint on how the speaker construes it. All right. So then we can define elicitation itself as the collection of responses to verbal or nonverbal stimuli designed to study the respondent's linguistic competence and or their practices of language use. All right, so the argument I'm going to make is that we can achieve a classification of all possible elicitation techniques by starting from a classification of the possible stimulus types and a classification of the possible response types, and letting the tasks simply be functions that map any possible stimulus type in a possible response type. This gives us 7 possible types of elicitation techniques. Starting from 4 stimulus types, a target language utterance, a contact language utterance, a linguistic representation, and a nonverbal representation, and the same 4 types for the response. So why do you wind up with 7 types rather than 8 or maybe 16? The reason it's not 16 is because all this stuff down here, while it's possible, you can do that. You can, for example, go from a contact language utterance to a judgment. Oh, I forgot to say that. That's right. Actually, there's not just 4 different response types. There's 5 different response types because you can collect a judgment, but you never apparently start from a judgment as the stimulus. Although I can come up with a situation in which that's possible. So, well, never mind. We can talk about that later, but it's interesting. I've got to make a mental note about that. You can go, for example, from a contact language utterance to a judgment, but if you do that, you're no longer testing the speaker's native language competence. You're now testing their competence in the contact language, the second language competence. So what happens here in these empty cells is you're going beyond target language elicitation. It may still be elicitation, but it's no longer target language elicitation. And why is it 7 and not 8? Because one type occurs twice, namely translation. Translation can lead from a contact language utterance to a target language utterance, but also vice versa, from a target language utterance to a contact language utterance. So that's why you wind up with 7 types. Now, if you followed along so far, you're bound to wonder what the heck is the difference between a target language utterance and a linguistic representation. What I mean by that is that in the case of the target language utterance, the utterance itself is the stimulus, whereas in the case of a linguistic representation, the target language utterance is only a vehicle to convey a particular meaning that you want the speaker to do something with. I'll make that a little more concrete when we see the examples. At least I'll try. And finally, before we leave this slide, it's important to understand, and you'll see that when we go through the examples, that generally speaking, most of what we do doesn't just involve a single type of task, but a combination of multiple of these tasks. All right, now, as I said, these aren't just possible elicitation techniques for semantics. In fact, they are possible elicitation techniques for any kind of linguistic data. And all of these also find their application in semantic research. So if you're starting from a given meaning and you want to know how this meaning is expressed in the language you're working on, you can use completion and association tasks, translation tasks, tasks of contextualized production, and description tasks. And if you're conversely interested in what a given expression in the target language means, you can use judgments of entailment or contradiction or felicity, pragmatic felicity. You can work with explications by paraphrase or by scenario, although we'll see what I mean by that. And you can use demonstrations or act out tasks. So now I'm going to try to illustrate the 7 possible types of elicitation techniques with examples from my own fieldwork on Yucatec Maya. But before I do that, I want to give you a little bit of background on this language that I've been working on for 20 years. It's the largest member of the Yucatecan branch of the Mayan language family, which is one of the branches that split off from the common language the earliest. It's currently spoken, according to the latest census data, by around 760,000 speakers age 5 or older in Mexico, in the 3 Mexican states of Campeche, Quintana Roo, and Yucatan. Those are the states that together comprise the Yucatan Peninsula, together with Belize, the former British Honduras. And there are some villages in Belize where Yucatec is also spoken. And I should say, between the 2000 and the 2005 census, the number of speakers actually dropped by about 40,000, which is scary. Except I'm not sure whether it reflects an actual change in the number of speakers or a change in methodology of the census, but I've never been able to ascertain this. It is unfortunately certainly the case that a drop in the actual number of speakers is plausible, because what I've seen over the course of the 20 years that I've been working there is that the number of families... I work in a small village, Yeshle, which is a village of about 600 people, has been stable in the number of, in the population figure for the entire 20 years that I've worked there. But there's been a dramatic shift in the number of families who raise their kids in Spanish rather than in Maya, due to changes in the education system, apparently. Okay, Yucatec is a polysynthetic language. It's a purely hat-marking language. It's a verb-initial language, although you don't necessarily see that in discourse, because there's a high, very high, it's a discourse configurational language, just like Mandarin, I presume, meaning topics are formally marked, and it's... very rarely the case that you encounter a clause with full noun phrases without one of them being topicalized. It also has a typologically highly unusual argument marking system, a split intransitive argument marking system that's based on viewpoint aspect, something very rare in the languages of the world. I already talked about this village. It's right in the center of the state of Quintana Roo, about 50 kilometers from the Caribbean coast as the crow flies, although culturally the sea is really not a part of people's lives at all. These people have been horticulturalists, tropical slash and burn horticulturalists for thousands and thousands of years. And their basic style of farming, of subsistence farming, hasn't changed much over the millennia. All right, and here you get some pictures from my field site and some pictures of the people I work with on a routinely basis. Okay, so Here we go. The first type of elicitation task that I want to take a look at is completion and association tasks. And when I talk about completion, I mean completion as in completing a sentence or a text with a gap, and association as in word association tasks. All right, so this is the type of task where the stimulus is a target language utterance, so in this case a Yucatec utterance, and the response is also a Yucatec utterance. You give the speaker a Yucatec utterance and you ask them to complete it or to tell you something, the first thing that comes to their mind when they hear this particular expression. And the example that I'm going to give you comes from a study that my colleagues at the Max Planck Institute for Psycholinguistics and I conducted about 10 years ago on verbs of cutting and breaking cross-linguistically. In this particular work that I did in the field, I had a specific question that went beyond the task that we defined for the group project, which was the old event representation project jointly directed by Melissa Baumann and myself. I was interested specifically in figuring out which of the Yucatec verbs of cutting and breaking were semantically specific, imposing specific selection restrictions on the theme, the object that is being broken or cut, and which were semantically specific in terms of selection restrictions on the instrument that was being used in the breaking or cutting. Now, I'm going to give you a little bit of background on the general study of cutting and breaking. What we did for this study is we filmed a set of 61 short video clips which showed various scenes in which people break or cut objects, and to create this set of clips, we basically used a grid where we classified possible kinds of objects with possible actions and or instruments. I'm going to show you real quick two examples of these clips, or at least I'll try. We'll see how that goes. Obviously, using a hammer or a mallet to induce separation in a shirt or a piece of cloth is not the most natural way of breaking it, but we got some very interesting responses to these clips. And of all the non-verbal elicitation tasks that I've done over the years, of all the non-verbal stimulus, this is one of the ones that we got the best speaker responses to, because around the world, people really liked these clips. They really liked to watch these clips. They had a lot of fun because, you know, obviously, well, it seems to be the case that humans universally like to watch stuff getting destroyed. Okay. Okay, so, well, people would watch these clips, and then we would ask a number of questions about them, such as what did the actor do in this clip, what happened to the theme, the patient, the object in this clip, and so on and so forth. And there were a number of different objectives. Asfar Majid and Melissa Baumann were predominantly interested in the semantics of verbs of cutting and breaking, and to what extent this conceptual domain is lexicalized differently in the languages of the world. And they did a study on the basis of that that I'll look at in more detail in, I think, lecture number 8, because they use a particular statistical approach for the analysis of the data, which is going to be interesting for us to think about. On the other hand, I was predominantly interested in the argument structure of verbs of cutting and breaking, meaning, basically the extent to which the lexical semantic properties of the verbs predicted their syntactic properties across languages. There was a strong prediction out there based on an old paper by Goersel and colleagues that came out of the old MIT Lexicon project in the 1980s, and I wanted to test that prediction. Well, we did, and it failed to confirm, which is good, because, you know, that's an interesting finding. Now, back to my association task. So what did I do to find out which of the Yucatec verbs of cutting and breaking are semantically specific in terms of the object that's being broken, and which verbs are specific in terms of the instrument that is being used? Basically, I used two different elicitation frames or elicitation prompts in order to get theme-specific verbs, if there are any. I want you to tell me, so this is a question I asked for each of these verbs that people had used to describe the clips, the 61 clips, right? I want you to tell me the kinds of objects that can be verbed, and here you would have to insert the particular verb that I was interested in. If you hear that somebody verbed something, what kind of thing are you going to think that it is that they verbed? And to get at instrument specificity, I would ask them, I want you to tell me the kinds of objects that one can verb with. If you hear that somebody verbed something, what kind of thing are you going to think it is that they verbed it with? So typical responses. For the verb hat, which means to tear, like tear a piece of cloth or a piece of paper, basically an object that has a fibrous structure. There's a lot of folk physics that goes into the conceptualization of this domain, which is very interesting. You would get, I did this with, 5, 6, 7 speakers. You get responses such as cloth, paper, leather, a plastic bag, a letter, one's hand, one's mouth or lips, shoes, and so on and so forth. So this is a wide range of objects, but it's coherent. All of these are objects that you can associate with some kind of fiber structure. As opposed to if you ask the same question with the verb shot, which means cut, you get, for example, rope, melon, squash, tomatoes, one's hand, one's claws, a plank or the table, another person, and so on and so forth. Meaning, this is a much less coherent class of objects. So my judgment on the basis of how much the responses would cluster around a particular conceptual type, the upshot for me was that the verb hat was theme-specific, whereas the verb shot was not. And conversely, on the instrument-specific side, the verb shot would elicit responses such as you can do it with a handsaw, a knife, a machete, a reaping hook, a hacksaw, and so on and so forth. All of these are bladed instruments. Whereas in the case of the verb hat, you would get, you can use your hands, you can use your feet, your mouth, you can use a stick, a machete, knife, an axe, a piece of wire, scissors, and so on and so forth. So some of these things are bladed, but by no means all of them are. And if there is a coherent theme here, I can't find it. So I concluded that this verb is not instrument specific. All right, here's some more classic literature on word association tasks. The original literature on this type of approach comes from language production research, of course, and research on lexical processing. More recently, there's a great paper by Nick Evans and David Wilkins on semantic metaphors of perception verbs in Australian languages, where they used word association techniques. All right, moving on to the second type, translation tasks, and I'm going to... I think this actually covers the third type as well. We'll see. So translation leads from a contact language utterance to a target language utterance, or vice versa, from a target language utterance to a contact language utterance. And of course, the problem, well, there are two fundamental problems with translation. Whoops. Too much technology on me. Two fundamental problems with translation tasks. One is you have insufficient control over how the speaker construes the stimulus. This is a general problem with any kind of elicitation, and I'll get back to that at the end of today's lecture. But specifically in the case of translation, a compounding factor is that by definition, since it's a contact language, it's not the speaker's native language, so they have their own non-native speaker variety of this language. It may not be the researcher's native language either, so that means the researcher also uses some second language speaker variety of this language. So basically, what's going on here is quite fuzzy. And then an additional problem that has long been noticed in connection with translation tasks is that the speaker may attempt to translate not just the meaning of the stimulus utterance, but also the form, the phenomenon known as interference. So they may try to produce a target language form that corresponds to the form of the stimulus utterance. All right. So the example I'm going to use is Östendahl's tense aspect mood questionnaire, which is not just an example of translation questionnaires themselves, but also an example of a, I think, very valid attempt at solving the problems inherent to translation tasks. Now, I don't know how familiar people are with Östendahl's typology of tense mood aspect systems and his questionnaires. If you've heard of Dahl's tense mood aspect questionnaire, raise your hand. Okay, very few people. It's a questionnaire consisting of originally around 156, I think, scenarios that Östendahl and his collaborators and students used to collect data on tense mood aspect systems from a very large number of languages. Classic study, and it's a very useful tool, I found. As I mentioned yesterday, I did my dissertation research on the tense mood aspect system of Yucatec. So for me, this was a very valuable tool, but I'm using it in every field methods class I teach because it gives you valuable data, not just on the tense mood aspect system of the language, but also on the basic verb grammar, which is pretty much the core of the grammatical structure of every language. Right. So what Dahl does in order to overcome those two fundamental problems of translation-based elicitation is he accompanies every stimulus utterance with a scenario in which this utterance is supposed to be interpreted. A scenario that's supposed to give context to the stimulus utterance and thereby clarifies the intended meaning. So for example, in this case, we want to ask the speaker for the translation of he was writing letters. Wait a minute. No, actually, he will be writing letters. So you're getting imperfective or progressive aspect, future time reference, and an eventuality type that is unbounded, italic, an activity, writing letters rather than one particular letter. And in order to clarify this to the speaker, you're using a context that defines the reference time of this utterance. And the context is, what do your brother do when we arrive, do you think? Now, this is actually not a grammatical utterance in English, and I'll explain in a second why that is the case. But basically, the context introduces a scenario in which we're talking about something that will be happening in the future, so we get a future reference time, and it will be happening at the moment that we arrive. So the question is, what activity will the brother be engaged in at the moment when we arrive? So this gives you imperfective or progressive aspect. Okay. So the reference time, which is crucial in research on tense mood aspect systems, is controlled by the context, by the scenario. And generally speaking, the best approach to running this task is to let the speaker translate not just the stimulus utterance, but also the context, the scenario. Okay? Just have them translate the whole thing. It's the most natural way to do that. Now, why is it that the context and the target, the stimulus utterance, are given in these ungrammatical forms using these infinitives in capital letters? That's Dahl's attempt at preventing the speaker from translating the form of the contact language stimulus utterance. So instead of giving them finite verb forms that may influence the finite verb forms the speaker produces in response, Dahl uses infinitives. And the idea is that the speaker try to figure out what it is that the researcher is trying to get at, and then insert in their mind the appropriate forms in the target language. Now, the first solution, meaning the use of these context scenarios, was very successful. It's a great idea. It's beautiful. It contributed a lot to the success of this tool. The second solution, the use of these infinitives, is not so great, because what it triggers almost universally for almost anybody who has ever tried this is a lot of confusion. Especially when you're working with illiterate speakers, so you have to read this out to them, which means you're giving them an ungrammatical sentence in the contact language. What your brother do when we arrive, do you think? Now, what's the speaker supposed to do with that? How are they going to interpret that ungrammatical sentence? So that's a problem. And I can't say that I've ever been able to solve this problem, but it's easy to go around it if you're working with speakers who are literate. You can show them a printout, or you can show them the items on your computer screen, and they understand, okay, there's something funny going on with these infinitives here because they appear in capital letters. If you're working with illiterate speakers, it's going to be tough. All right, so the reason I said that this is actually an example not just for type 2 translation, but also for type 3, and remember, type 3
well, you, oops.
You won't remember, but I'll remind you. Type 3 goes from a linguistic representation to a target language utterance. So I said this is the use of an utterance in the target language or in a contact language that serves not itself as a stimulus, but rather as a vehicle for a particular meaning that you're trying to get across. And in this case, that's exactly what happens in the DAR questionnaire. The context is not actually an utterance, the translation of which you're per se interested in. Rather, it's something that you're using to set up a scenario that serves as a context in which the speaker is supposed to produce the target utterance. All right, so that leads us to type 4, which is the description of nonverbal stimuli. And this is really the mainstay in my narrow field of specialization, semantic typology. Most of the research in semantic typology has been based on descriptions of nonverbal stimuli. Example, Berlin and Case seminal study of basic color terms, those Munsell color chips that they use to elicit the semantics of color terms across languages. You know, that's the classic example of a nonverbal stimulus. And we can talk some more about why it is that nonverbal stimuli are so important for semantic typology. But for now, there's a wide range of different types of nonverbal stimuli that people have been using. We already saw examples yesterday of the Baupert line drawings, which show different spatial configurations of objects. We saw one example of a task that involves photographs, the ball and chair task. I only had that up on one slide yesterday very briefly, but we'll talk more about it. Objects, three-dimensional physical objects, we're going to see that during lecture 7, the novel objects task, something that my colleagues and I developed for the research on spatial frames of reference. You can use comics and picture books. A very famous example is the children's picture book, Frog, Where Are You?, which Ruth Berman and Dan Slobin have been using in research on cross-linguistic research on child language. And then, of course, video clips such as the cut and break clips, which we already saw. Oh, yeah, so these are, in fact, some examples of the Baupert pictures, those line drawings. So Baupert consists of 71 line drawings featuring so-called topological relations. This is topological in not in the mathematical sense, but in the sense that was introduced in child psychology, developmental psychology, by Jean Piaget and Bärbel Imhelder. And that was in the 1950s, I want to say 1956 or 1959, something like that. In a famous book called The Psychology of the Child. So they had the idea that the simplest kind of spatial relations are topological relations, meaning relations that are perspective-free, that don't depend on a particular viewpoint, such as support, inclusion, and so on and so forth. Okay. All right. So there is a number of problems that are associated with the use of nonverbal stimuli. First of all, it's very important to be specific about the task you're giving the speaker. Nonverbal stimuli are kind of deceptive in that way, deceptive for the researcher, that is. When I see students work for the first time with nonverbal stimuli. A lot of them do the same thing, which is they assume, okay, great, I'm just going to show this video clip or I'm going to show this picture, and then the speaker will produce what I want to hear. And I'm done. And of course, that doesn't work. Because what happens is, let's say in the case of the Baupack pictures, your goal is locative description. So let's say in each picture, one object is selected, it's marked by an arrow, that's supposed to be the figure of a locative description you're trying to elicit. And the other object is the ground with respect to which you want the speaker to locate the object. So, therefore, you ask the speaker, okay, tell me where the cup is with respect to this example. And the speaker looks at you and looks some more, like you're not quite with it, maybe. The speaker says, well, it's right here in the picture. Can't you see? So, what happened here, of course, is that the speaker was absolutely right. The mistake was entirely on the part of the researcher. The researcher gave a very imprecise instruction to the speaker. Okay, so here's a more appropriate version, although this is admittedly very elaborate. This is another example of an elicitation prompt or an elicitation frame. Imagine you're talking to, so this is something that you're telling the speaker before they produce the utterance you want to hear. Imagine you're talking to somebody who's looking for the figure. So in this case, imagine you're talking to someone who's looking for the cup. This person knows where the cup is, but doesn't know where... this person knows where the table is, but doesn't know where the cup is. You know where the cup is, but neither of you can actually see the cup and the table right now. And the person asks you, where's the cup? Imagine you want to tell that person where the cup is, how do you respond? Okay, well, that's very involved, and especially if you have to repeat it every time with every new picture, it's going to be very tedious, and it's going to get the informant, the consultant, annoyed and exhausted very quickly. So what's important is you make sure that the speaker gets the hang of this, understands what you're trying to do, and once that is the case, you don't need to repeat this over and over again. You just once in a while might want to make sure that the speaker still remembers. All right. Next, visual stimuli have been used not just in production tasks, but also in comprehension tasks, especially in child language research. In fact, a lot of this work with nonverbal stimuli was pioneered in child language research, and from there has been exported to cross-linguistic research on indigenous languages. You use nonverbal stimuli, for example, in verification tasks where you ask a speaker, okay, here's an utterance. Is this the scenario that's shown in this particular picture here a good example of what this utterance says? Is this utterance true? That's why it's called a verification task. Is this utterance true in this particular picture? And you can do that even with small children. You can, for example, use a hand puppet of Cookie Monster or something like that, and you show them a picture, and you say, well, okay, so Cookie Monster says that there are two cookies in this picture. Does Cookie Monster tell the truth, or is Cookie Monster confused again? And nonverbal stimuli are used in matching tasks, which are often in turn used in referential communication tasks, tasks that involve two speakers of the language interacting with one another. And we'll see examples of that as we go along. Oh, in fact, here you see this is the basic outline of a picture matching task, such as the ball and chair task, which I did mention before, which is an example of a referential communication task. So in this case, you have two speakers and a screen between them. Actually, let me go back a little to the pictures, the photographs that I showed you from my field site. This photo shows you two speakers doing the ball and chair task. And you see I'm using my suitcase, the suitcase I use to haul my field equipment, the camera and so on and so forth, as a screen. And each of the two speakers has a set of 12 pictures, 12 photographs in front of them, each photograph showing a ball and a chair. They only differ from one another in the location of the ball with respect to the chair and in the orientation of the chair. One speaker picks a picture, describes it, and the other speaker has to find the corresponding picture in their set. And the order of the pictures in the two sets are different. Is different. All right. So the point of this, the referential communication task type, is to force two speakers to be referentially maximally explicit. So on the one hand, because you have an interaction between two speakers of the language, they themselves get to choose what is the most appropriate task, the most appropriate strategy, to solve this task in their native language. But on the other hand, and so in particular, if you're interested in preferences in communicative behavior, this is a great task. So in the line of research on spatial frames of reference, we're interested in what types of reference frame speakers of different languages prefer to use. So therefore, this is a very productive type of approach. And on the other hand, the screen, the fact that these two speakers can't share visual attention, forces them to be linguistically maximally explicit about the referential content of their utterances, which, of course, renders this type of task very artificial, because generally speaking, this is not a natural communication context. Generally speaking, when people interact, they share a visual field. They don't necessarily talk face-to-face. That's the common mistake that European researchers in particular have been making since in the Euro-American cultural context. Face-to-face is the default of dyadic conversation, but that's not the case in many other cultures. But generally speaking, they're in the same place, they share a visual field, and so this is not a particularly natural type of task. And what about that? What does that mean in terms of ecological validity of the data that you're collecting with this task? Of course, what it means is you never want to rely, when analyzing the linguistic practices of this community, on the results of such an artificial task alone. You always want to check whatever you got out of that task against other more natural, more ecologically valid observations. Okay, finally, very important, the interpretation. So this is the general point that I raised before. Whenever you're doing elicitation, you have to be aware that ultimately the speaker is not responding to the stimulus, or rather that their response does not directly reflect the stimulus itself, but rather their conceptual construal, their interpretation of the stimulus. And that interpretation may be subject to cultural conventions. The classic example that I like to use to illustrate this is an anecdote that comes from my colleague and friend David Wilkins. David did a study on the acquisition of motion verbs in children learning Arendi, a Pamandungan language of Central Australia, of the area around Alice Springs. And so he created a series of line drawings that were supposed to show, illustrate different manners of motion, such as this one, which was supposed to show a galloping horse. And the Arendt children looked at this picture and they got very sad and they said, well, that's a dead horse. Okay, so that took David a bit to figure out. It turns out, of course, that the default perspective for visual representations in many Aboriginal cultures in Australia is not horizontal as in Western visual art and visual representations. I believe also that's the case in China, but rather it's a top-down bird's eye perspective. So if you imagine that you're seeing this horse from above, that means the horse has got to be lying on the ground. And if you know something about horses, horses generally don't lie like that unless they are not that well. So then what about all these dust clouds here, which David added to the picture in order to animate the horse, that was supposed to show that the horse was running very fast? Well, the kids interpreted that as the traces of rigor mortis that the horse had left behind in the dirt when it died. And of course, cultural conventions for the interpretation of visual representations don't just change from place to place, they also change over time. So even in European culture, conventions for visual representation have changed a great deal since the Middle Ages. And a great example for that is the Bayeux tapestry, which is however you call this thing, a tapestry, a rug, the very long rug that you put on a wall, which shows the events of the Norman conquest of England, such as in this case, in this sequence here, the death of Edward the Confessor. Basically, the way this... this rug, this tapestry, is supposed to be interpreted is sort of as a cartoon strip, except that the different panels of the cartoon are not separated from one another. So, in effect, what's happening here is the temporal sequence, temporal proximity, is translated as spatial proximity. So all the events of the Norman conquest are basically shown in a spatial sequence. So it looks as though these things happen all at the same time in different but adjacent places. That's the way we would interpret that nowadays, but the way it was intended is to show a sequence of events. The next type I want to look at is the elicitation of judgments. This is partly animated, which is unfortunate. In this case, the stimulus is a target language utterance, and the response is a judgment about this utterance, which can be a judgment of syntactic well-formedness. It can be a judgment of semantic interpretability, a judgment of contradiction versus the absence of contradiction. It can be a judgment of pragmatic felicity, and so on. And the example I want to give is one of testing event descriptions for telicity. So what's telicity? It's the property of event descriptions of having an inherent goal that has to be achieved in order for the event that's being described to be realized. And some event descriptions have this property and others don't. So we already saw the example of Sally watched an episode of Red Dwarf versus Sally watched Red Dwarf. You can be watching Red Dwarf without there being any inherent endpoint that you need to reach in order to have accomplished something. As soon as you start watching Red Dwarf, you have watched Red Dwarf. In contrast, if you're watching an episode of Red Dwarf, then until you've actually finished that episode, you haven't actually watched the episode. So that would be an example of a telic description. All right, and here you see the classification of event descriptions into states, activities, accomplishments, and achievements that goes back to Zeno Wendler. Telic descriptions are the states, are the accomplishments and the achievements. The states and the activities are atelic. And the other two properties that define this four-way classification are the property of dynamicity and durativity, the distinction between durative and instantaneous events. Okay, so I wanted to test Yukatek event descriptions for telicity. Now, for English, people have observed over the years a number of correlates of telicity. This is a table that goes back to a book by David Dowdy from 1979, and it points out, for example, that telic descriptions use... Oh boy, we have a lot of different tests here. Use four-type adverbials, whereas atelic descriptions use in-type adverbials. Telic descriptions go with finish, whereas atelic descriptions do not. And both of them go with stop, but if you apply stop to a telic description, then the implication is that the eventuality was never realized. Now, these particular tests that I just mentioned actually rely on syntactic properties of event descriptions in English. And it turns out that these syntactic properties are not universal. For example, I believe that the distinction between four-type and in-type adverbials does not apply to Mandarin, and it also doesn't apply to... I could be wrong. I might be misremembering this. But there was an article about that a number of years ago. But it also doesn't apply to Yukatek. In fact, Yukatek has no syntactic correlates of telicity. So there's likewise no distinction. There is a distinction between stop type spectral verbs and finish type spectral verbs, but all Yukatek event descriptions are in fact compatible with the latter. All right, so what I did instead is rely on this entailment pattern that we already looked at yesterday. So here's another example of the same pattern. If it's true that Floyd was pushing a cart, that means it also must be true already that he pushed a cart. As soon as it's true that Floyd was pushing a cart, it's also true that he pushed a cart. So that's an entailment. That makes push a cart an atelic description. In contrast, if it's true that Floyd was drawing a circle, it does not necessarily follow that Floyd drew a circle. That depends on whether he actually completed the circle. So draw a circle is one of these eventualities that have an inherent endpoint. In other words, the description is telic. So this is what I used with Yukatek speakers. I set up a scenario in which an eventuality of the requisite kind was interrupted, and I asked at this point, can you say that the eventuality has already been realized? Now, this is, of course, a very abstract thing to do. It requires a lot of focus on the part of the speaker. And in addition, you have to find a scenario in which this makes sense for the speaker. And the only way to do that is to negotiate a possible scenario for each verb that you want to test with the speaker. And negotiate with them an example, a context, a scenario in which an action or event of the particular kind can be interrupted. So here's an example. In this case, the verb I want to test is the verb kai, which means thing. So the context that we came up with this particular speaker is Pedro Etanukai. Pedro, he was singing, Kadukaduba Pablo, and then Pablo interfered. Pedro Etupadukai. Pedro stopped singing. Beoratz or Waukai Pedro. Now has Pedro sung? Interestingly, the answer of most Yucatec speakers, now the answer from an English perspective that would be expected here is the answer yes, because in English, sing is italic, it's an activity, it doesn't have an inherent endpoint. But on closer inspection, of course, sing has a cognate object, a song, and even for an English speaker, you may assume that when you sing, you generally sing a song. A song has an inherent endpoint, so you haven't actually sung until you've completed that song. It's just that for English speakers, this interpretation is not very prominent. For Yucatec speakers, this is much more prominent. Why? Because Yucatec, like many Mayan languages, does not have a lot of basic unergative verbs, basic activity verbs. Rather, activities in Wendler sense are lexicalized primarily as nouns. Or alternatively, they are lexicalized in a class of parts of speech that can be used as nouns or verbs without overt morphological derivation either way. Action nominals, they're called among Mayanists. So this morpheme, kai, does not just mean sing, it also means song. This bound pronominal marker here can be interpreted not just as an ergative marker of the single argument of this verb, but also as a possessor marker, which is the reason why it's called not ergative, but rather A3. It's a set A marker, as Mayanists call it. It conflates the function of ergative and possessor. That means this does not just mean he is singing, but also his song is going on. And this does not just mean has he sung, but also did his song finish? Because what I'm translating here as a perfect aspect, tok, the so-called terminative, is actually a grammaticalization of a verb that means to end. Because of this ambiguity, let's just call it an ambiguity, but let's not try to attach too much theoretical significance to that. Because of this ambiguity, the interpretation has Pedro sung and the interpretation did Pedro's song finish are both salient to the Yucatec speaker. And as a result, a lot of speakers will say no in response to this question. Which makes another very important point about elicitation in general, which is when you're interpreting the speaker's response, you cannot take it at face value. The speaker's response becomes a data point of your analysis only once you've taken into account how the speaker interpreted the stimulus and how the speaker interpreted your task and how the speaker interpreted their own response, intended their own response to be interpreted by you. Now, when you're doing this complicated thing of testing for possible scenarios which instantiate and satisfy the semantics of a target language expression, it's usually a big help if you can use nonverbal stimuli to help clarify that scenario. So in that case, you would use a combination of a linguistic utterance and a nonverbal stimulus in order to get the best possible, the most accurate judgment by the native speakers. And I'm going to illustrate that with an example on research I've done on verbs of inherently directed motion, as Bess Levine calls them, or past verbs, as Len Tarmi calls them, meaning verbs such as enter and exit and so on and so forth. And the background here is an important study that my former colleague Sotaro Kita did on Japanese, where he showed that Japanese hairu and deru, enter and exit, actually are more appropriately translated into English as become inside and become outside, because they don't necessarily entail that the figure, the entity whose motion is at issue, did in fact move rather than the ground. So, let me see, do I have this? No. Let's say you start out with a square inside a circle, and you wind up with a situation where the square is outside the circle. One possibility is, of course, that the square has moved, and in that case, you can use deru. But another possibility is that the circle has moved, and now the square came to be outside the circle because the circle moved. And in that case, too, you can use deru in Japanese. But you can't use exit in English. So I wanted to know of which kind the apparent past verbs of English were, whether they were of the Japanese kind or of the English kind. Did I say English? I meant Yucatec. So whether the Yucatec past verbs, or location change verbs, were of the kind the English past verbs are, or whether they were of the kind the hairu and deru, possibly other location change verbs of Japanese are. So I used a series of video clips that was designed by Steve Levinson, the so-called motion verb clips, and I'm going to show you some examples right now. So in this case, can you say that the ball entered the enclosure? But Yucatec speakers will say just that. Now, and in this case, can you say that the ball ascended the slope or rolled up the slope? And again, English speakers will tend to say no, but we'll see in a moment what Yucatec speakers do. So, when you present this clip to a Yucatec speaker and you ask them, is it possible to say Nakle Chankanika Yokle Tablau, the little marble, the ball in other words, ascended to the top of the plank. You're using the clip to define the situation and the utterance to ask the speaker, is this a possible, accurate, truthful description of this particular scenario? So it's a combination of two stimuli, the utterance, and the video clip. Basically, what we saw before the break as a verification task. It's a kind of verification task. Okay, now, what response do you get? Well, out of context, Yucatec speakers will tell you, no, that's not true. But that's not the whole story, as we're going to see in a moment. So the response to this typically is going to be negative. No, it did not ascend to the top of the plank. But the reason of this for this is that this utterance out of context will trigger a stereotype implicature, meaning a pragmatic inference that enriches the interpretation of the utterance, even though it's not actually part of the utterance semantic meaning. And that implicature will interpret the utterance to the effect that it was, in fact, the ball that moved, which isn't the case. It's not true in this video clip. Therefore, speakers will say no. So in other words, the point is quite simply that Yucatec speakers, just as English speakers, or probably Mandarin speakers, will assume that it's much more likely when they hear an utterance like this that it was the ball that moved rather than that it was the plank that moved. Okay? But that's not, in fact, part of the semantics of the utterance. It's just an implicature. So that implicature can be defeated. And one way to defeat it is to simply deny right up front that it was the ball that moved, or rather assert right up front that it was in fact the plank that moved. So you can say, le chantabla o pek nahi, the little plank, it moved, kahnake chankanika yeteche teyoklo, and the little ball and the stick ascended to the top. This is something that Yucatec speakers overwhelmingly will find perfectly acceptable as a description of this particular video clip. And notice, of course, if it was the case that motion of the figure was actually part of the entailments, the contribution that this verb makes to the overall meaning of a sentence in which it occurs, then this ought to be a contradiction. And Yucatec speakers will not say that this is a contradiction. They will find this perfectly acceptable. Notice, first of all, again, this is something that I didn't simply make up and give to the speakers. It's something that I had to negotiate with each speaker. So if you're doing this kind of task with 5 or 6 or 7 speakers, you have to negotiate an appropriate utterance with every speaker. So this can be quite involved and time-consuming. And furthermore, it instantiates another type of task, our type number 6, which leads from an utterance as stimulus to a verbal representation. So in this case, what do I mean by verbal representation? Again, the verbal representation is itself an utterance, but it's not the form of the utterance, the syntactic or morphological form, or even the words that occur in it that are part of the response. It's just the meaning that is a part of the response. In other words, what I'm doing here is I'm asking the speaker to describe to me a scenario in which something could be said, a particular utterance could be said. And this is how I got this as a possible description that's consistent with the situation shown in the video clip. I got this by negotiating with the speaker. Can you think of a case, a scenario, a situation in which somebody might truthfully say the little marble ascended to the top of the plank with respect to this video clip, talking about the scene that's shown in this video clip? And then the speaker said, well, yeah, you know, we can do that. You just have to say, actually, the plank moved, and then the video clip, the ball, the marble ended up on top of the plank. And this is an approach that I've used a lot, meaning asking speakers, can you think of a scenario, can you describe to me a scenario under which somebody might say this kind of thing, and it would be a truthful statement or about this particular situation here. And that's something you cannot do with any speaker. It requires a certain... Some people have a knack for this kind of thing. It requires a little bit of imagination. It requires a little bit of verbal intelligence in order to be able to do that. And some people have a knack for this kind... It doesn't require any education. People don't have to have education. They don't have to have training. Some people just have a knack for this kind of thing and some people don't. Other consultants are very good at producing paradigms of inflectional forms for you. Some people are very good at transcription and so on and so forth. There's a range of different skills that make native speaker consultants good consultants. This is one skill that I, as a semanticist, value very, very highly. All right. And finally, the last type, that's demonstrations and act-out tasks. So that leads from a target language utterance to a nonverbal representation that instantiates the target language utterance. And I'm going to show you... Let me just show you the video clip and I'll explain a little bit while I'm doing that. Mayan languages... Oh, now I can use this thing here. Mayan languages... have a very rich set of roots, not necessarily verb roots, which lexicalize what Mayanists typically call positions, but which are more appropriately called dispositions, because while the prototype of these kinds of configurations may be positions, postures of animate beings, humans and animals. Oh, I forgot to put that clip on here. I'm sorry. Okay, too bad, but can't be helped. Well, maybe, no, never mind. Okay. Sorry about that. So the prototype may be postures of human and animal bodies, but the majority of the roots actually lexicalize spatial properties of inanimate objects. And they're not locations. They are rather what you might want to call manners of location. That's a metaphor that a former student of mine came up with. They will, these roots lexicalize properties such as support, sustain, suspension, blockage of motion, orientation, mainly in the gravitational field, shape, configuration of parts of the figure with respect to one another, and so on and so forth. So for example, what that means in practice is Yucatec has... seven, eight different roots, all of which mean hang, and they describe different kinds of hanging configurations. Seven or eight different roots that mean lean, seven or eight different roots that mean be stuck on or in, and so on and so forth. And if you think that's a lot, Yucatec has altogether maybe 160, 170 of these roots. Other Mayan languages have 700, 800 of them. So this is a very rich semantic field in Mayan languages. And of course, most of these concepts are not lexicalized in better studied languages. They're not lexicalized at anywhere near this level of specificity in languages such as English or German or Spanish. I'm not sure about Mandarin, although I think I would have heard about it. So, in other words, what I'm saying is when you're trying to describe something like that, where a whole class of lexical items, a whole category, doesn't have counterparts in languages that you're familiar with, you don't even know where to look for the possible meanings of these items. You don't know the dimensions of this semantic space. You don't know the dimensions of contrast that you need to assume in order to describe the meanings of these lexical items. So what I wanted to do is get a handle at this, and what I used is an approach that was pioneered by Brent Berlin in the 1960s in his famous research on numeral classifiers in another Mayan language, Tzeltal. It's a two-pronged approach or a two-phase approach. During the first phase, I produced all the roots that I knew with a series of with a number of five or six speakers, and I asked them each time for each root, I asked each speaker, tell me all the different objects that you can think of that can be said to be in this particular disposition, the disposition described by this particular root. And then I compiled the responses and I sorted them according to classes of objects. And I came up with the 20 most frequent object classes. And then I got toys, objects that would instantiate the 20 different classes, props, if you will, props for the elicitation. And I arrayed all roots that occurred with a particular class of objects in a group, and I asked each speaker to show me contrastively all the different dispositions the object has to be in so that it can be said that a particular root applies to it. So, for example, if I had brought this clip, and I probably can find it on my USB drive, but then I have to take this thing out and it's going to take too long. This would show you a series of different dispositions that one speaker instantiates exemplars of using rope. That's just one class of objects. Rope, which you see here on the table, stands for one particular type of object class. And what I'm doing is I'm giving the speaker all the different roots that, according to the first phase, can occur with this type of object, with rope, and I'm asking her, okay, so now show me how the rope needs to be manipulated, what configuration the rope needs to be in, such that it can be said that it's in this particular disposition described by this particular root. So in other words, the response is what the speaker does with the rope. So that's what we call a demonstration. The speaker demonstrates the referential content of the root in this particular situation. An act-out task is something, is a situation, is the same thing. The speaker demonstrates the referential content, but they do it with their own body. So let's say you're studying manners of motion and you ask, okay, so this particular thing, can you show me what it means to move in this manner? And the speaker goes like this, right? That would be an example of an act-out task. If you're studying cutting and breaking and you want to know the particular manner of action that's associated with a particular work, you ask the speaker and they go, bam! That would be an example of an act-out response. All right. Wow, we're running over time. So, very quickly, discussion. I have 2 points in the discussion that I wanted to make. One is the difference between elicitation and experimentation, because there's an unfortunate tendency to call anything that involves nonverbal stimuli experimental research. We don't need to talk about where this comes from, but fundamentally it's based on a misunderstanding or a loose understanding of what it means to do an experiment. In the narrow sense, an experiment always involves a hypothesis that you're testing. Elicitation does not, at least not necessarily. You could say that as soon as you use elicitation to test the hypothesis, it becomes experimental research. But elicitation isn't inherently experimental research. Whether you use nonverbal stimuli or not doesn't matter. It's irrelevant. Very important, I already said this several times today, when you're interpreting elicitation responses, you have to take into account how the speaker construed the task, how they construed the stimulus, and how they intended their response. We've seen examples of all of this. I call this the golden rule of elicitation. An elicitation response only becomes a data point in the reconstruction of a speaker's linguistic competence once the speaker's interpretation of the task and stimulus and the intended interpretation of the response have been ascertained. All right, very quick summary. Linguistic data collection techniques can be classified in terms of three components: a stimulus, a task, and a response. Methods for eliciting expressions of a given meaning include completion of association tasks, translation, contextualized production and description tasks, and methods for eliciting meanings of a given expression include the collection of judgments of entailment, contradiction, and felicity, the explication of the meaning by paraphrase or by scenario, and demonstration and act-out tasks. The epistemology of elicitation, well, that's something we actually didn't talk about. Fundamentally, native speakers apply their linguistic knowledge to solving a certain problem, and the researcher reconstructs that knowledge based on the observation of the solution. This is something that I think is pretty much unique to linguistics and cultural anthropology. Fundamentally, the way I like to think of this is, imagine you're a Martian scientist and you want to know, you want to study the knowledge of human car mechanics. And the way you do that is you buy a number of cars and you muck them up and you give them to these mechanics and you study what they do to fix them. That's basically what we do as linguists in the field. We break stuff for the native speaker and we get them to fix it. And from there we try to infer their native speaker knowledge. Okay, and finally, the golden rule of elicitation: a response becomes a data point in the reconstruction of a speaker's linguistic competence once the speaker's interpretation of the task, the stimulus, and the response have been ascertained. And that's the end.